going with the DCF, I just want to say a couple words about Ann Sappenfield, who I've had the honor of working with ever since I was a freshman legislator 10 years ago on the Judiciary Committee, and she has staffed me on the Criminal Justice Committee. And she is the best of the best, 100% awesome. And she informed me yesterday, thank you for the notice, that tomorrow is her last day with Ledge Council. So this is it. We don't get to have Ann anymore. So whatever comes out of this will be squarely on the shoulders of Margit. Who I'm not worried at all about. However, I do want to say that, Ann, it has been a privilege and an honor to work with you. I'm very, very disappointed to hear that you're moving on, but if it's good for your life, I hope so. And she's going to the Audit Bureau, which sounds horrendously boring. However, I sat on finance, and that's not always a bowl of cherries. But God bless you, and good luck to you. And so we do have a cake. We're going to have to cut it in small pieces. Mm-hmm. But we'll give Ann our gratitude. Thank you. This is her last day. Would you like to say a few words?
Well, it's been great working here. It's been great working with all of you, and I've enjoyed working in this area. And that's one thing that I'll miss, is working in the child welfare area as much as I do, because there are just so many people who put their lives into this. I really appreciate knowing all of you, so thank you very much.
And thanks for the work you've done on this committee so far. All right. Okay, well, DCF is here. How are you guys doing? Yes, Mr. Schabelsky.
Before we get to our distinguished guests from DCF, one quick follow-up from this morning. We were talking about the fact that we were trying to identify names and making sure that some of the names of the adoptive families went to the Disability Resource Center. Yes. Yeah. Sorry. Look at Oriana and I said that. The Adoption Resource Center. But anyway, one of the things that when Bob Pop was here, he talked about that families come to our agencies typically when they've trained almost as run off the track. And is there a possibility that we could look at, along with those names, developing available resources that are out there for families? Those resources, whether they come from the state, the counties, the Adoption Resource Center, along with that, so they have access to resources prior to the beginning of the crisis? Just something to consider.
So tell me again what the legislation would look like?
Not quite sure about that.
Well, it's not too late at our next meeting to propose writing legislation. I just want everybody to know that. If you come up with ideas while we're gone.
Just something that we have talked about, by the time we get involved with families, they're past crisis
point. Yeah. And we had talked about that yesterday, too. It's just really difficult to, it's tough to catch it ahead of time. No, very good. If you can think of a way that we can incorporate that into some language, let us know. DCF.
Okay.
Hit it.
Okay. So thank you for inviting us here. My name is Freddie Bove. I'm the administrator for the Division of Safety and Permanence in the Department of Children and Families. With me are Therese Sturkin, who is one of our attorneys in the department, Ron Hermes, and Janelle Brum, who directly oversee the adoption and out-of-home care areas. I also want to point out that I'll be using a PowerPoint. All the members have been given a copy. There also are extra copies outside for anyone who doesn't have it. Okay. We needed some technical assistance here.
Enter.
Probably have to hit the button.
Which one?
We do have it all on sheets, too.
Yes, okay. Okay, so.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Chanel does it all.
Okay, so as starting off, I just wanted, as context, to remind you of what the role of our department is. So we do have responsibilities either directly in Milwaukee or through the counties to place children who are in the child welfare system with adoptive parents if those children aren't able to reunite with their birth families or if there isn't a relative who's able to take on permanent guardianship. So our role is extensive. We recruit identify the adoptive parents. We do conduct the assessments for those prospective parents. We ensure that the parent completes the training, and we also are responsible for setting the level of and administering the adoption assistance payments. In contrast, we have a very, very limited role in private adoptions, both domestic and international. Our role there really is mostly limited to licensing the child placing agencies, who are the ones who carry out all of those responsibilities that I just talked about. So it's not DCF that does the recruitment or the assessment of the parents or the training in cases of private adoptions. And I know that was covered in material you saw, but I just wanted to kind of reorient you to that. So what I will present today in this presentation are the items that you as a committee asked us to address. So they're a little disjointed because they came at us at various points in time. So I wanted to just show you what will be covered in case you have a particular interest, you'll know that it's coming up. So there are several items related to public adoptions that you asked questions about. In the areas of how prospective parents are assessed, how we match kids and parents, and how we administer the adoption assistance payments. There were a number of questions around post-adoption supports. There are also, I'll be covering the issue of legal restrictions regarding disclosure of information related to adoption. I'll be covering the requirements for child welfare worker training. CPS stands for Child Protective Services. And then I'll also cover information about federal child welfare funding. Okay, so again, focusing on the kids that are adopted from the child welfare system, which for shorthand purposes I'll call public adoptions. I thought it would be helpful to just share some background data, which you may have already been exposed to, but again, it's, I think, useful context. So each year, there's about 700 children who are adopted from the child welfare system. I also think it's important to remember that that's really just a slice of all of the kids that go into out-of-home care. So the majority of kids that enter the child welfare system who need to be removed from their home and go into foster care are reunited with their parents. Another portion are able to live with relatives on a permanent basis. But there is a slice, about 15%, who do move on to adoption. And that's the focus, of course, of your committee. Another important background piece to keep in mind is that the vast majority of children who are adopted through the public child welfare system are adopted by their foster parent. So 85% of the adoptive parents have been the foster parent of that child. And that's a good thing because that avoids another disruption for the child if in fact that was a good match.
Is there a high success rate percentage-wise among those adopted by foster parents?
So as you know, we don't have hard data on the number of adoptions that dissolve. So we don't know if the rate is slightly higher if you were a foster parent previously or not. So that's one of the many data questions that right now we don't have data on. Another factor, background factor, is it does take about a little less than 3 years in terms of the average length of time from when a child enters out of home care until the adoption is finalized. And that includes all the court processes in between. And then we also wanted to highlight for the committee that There have been a number of initiatives in recent years, including some that were sponsored by the legislature, that have served to strengthen permanency outcomes for children in the child welfare system. And permanency outcomes include adoptions. They also include, as I said, reunification with birth families and guardianships. But we've had a number of initiatives, such as permanency roundtables and concurrent planning, all of which are designed to really move children as quickly as possible to a permanent setting, whether it's a birth family or an adoptive family or a relative.
What is concurrent planning?
Yep. What is concurrent planning? Concurrent planning means that when a child enters the child welfare system and is in out-of-home care, we always try to see if reunification is possible. With concurrent planning, we simultaneously, concurrently, work on other options if that's not going to work out, so that we don't delay the permanency for the child. So at the same time we're working on reunification with the birth parent, we might be working on adoption or a relative guardianship.
Okay.
Oops, I'm on the other side. How do I go backwards, Janelle? All right, we'll go backwards to the assessment of prospective, Okay. So the next slide, this slide describes what our process is for assessing prospective adoptive parents. So at the adoption stage, all prospective adoptive parents who are adopting from the public child welfare system are assessed using a standard tool that's a national tool called the Structured Analysis Family Evaluation. It goes by the acronym
SAFE.
Right. Some of the things to keep in mind here are that many counties, 52 counties, also use the same tool at the foster parent assessment stage. If the foster parent has already been assessed using SAFE, they don't need to go through another assessment at the adoptive parent stage. So again, remember 85% of those adoptive parents were foster parents. If they had that SAFE assessment, then they don't need to repeat it. SAFE is a national tool. It's used in 24 states. Private adoptions are not required to, but some do use the same tool.
Joel, can I ask a question?
Sure.
You said 52 counties use SAFE. Is there a reason why the other 20 don't?
So 52 counties use it, again, at the foster parent stage. I want to just make sure we're talking about the right, the different stages of the process. We as a department have encouraged all counties to use it. It hasn't been a requirement to date, but we encourage all counties to use it.
Okay.
It will be, they will after our legislation goes through.
Or something they're close to.
Yes, I understand that was a topic of conversation this morning. Some of the other questions that I arose in other discussions you've had related to the age requirements. So to be an adoptive parent for public adoption, there is a requirement that the person be at least 21, unless it's a relative, in which case the minimum age is 18. We do not have an upper age limit, but as you can see by the next bullet, all adoptive parents, regardless of their age, are assessed in terms of their health capacity and assessed to determine if they can care for the child through the age of majority. So it's not just an assessment, can you take care of the child for the next 6 months? It's yes, do you have the capability, if it's a four-year-old, to care for that child up until age 18. We also, as pointed out in the last bullet point, we do ask or discuss with adoptive parents the importance of having some kind of a backup plan if they get incapacitated, just like for a birth parent, it's important to have that kind of.
I have a question for you, Freddie.
Sure.
In your assessment, your safe tool assessment, that includes background checks too, right?
We do background checks. Is it technically part of the safe tool, or is it separate from it?
Well, the federal laws are outside, but we have incorporated it into our safe tool, so it fills into the safe study that someone does.
And when you do those background checks, does that include a component where you compare names to the sex registry list?
Yes.
Yes.
It's a reverse address check, and then the DOJ, the Department of Justice check would tell you if someone's a sex offender or not.
Okay, and that's for the adoptive parents as well as anyone inside the home?
Yes.
It's over 18.
Thank you.
Quick question about the safe assessment. Not having seen it or gone through it, would the way that you answer the questions, if you're considering being a foster parent, be different than the way you would answer the questions if you were considering being an adoptive parent? Again, not having seen the tool, I don't know.
So there's some additional questions that you would be asking someone who's doing an adoption. So even the study is done, even if done for fostering, but you would ask some of the questions differently in terms of in the long term or specific to this child that you are going to adopt and your preparedness to care for them to the age of majority. When you're fostering, it's more general questions, type of children you're going to be caring for. It's not about specific, it could be about specific kids if that's all you're being licensed for, but they're more general questions.
And then why would the expanded version or the assessment not be readministered to parents who are adopting?
So it's not fully readministered, but there may be an updated component specific to that child. So we don't need to fully ask every single
right.
question about their history and how they problem solve, but we do need to ask about specific questions for that specific child that they're going to be adopting.
But at this point, that doesn't necessarily happen?
That happens.
It does happen, because
yes.
I was, it does,
if
it
they're
sounds
doing
like what you're saying, that once they, if they've taken it, as a foster parent, it's not readministered as potentially as an adoptive parent.
Yeah, I probably didn't answer as carefully as Janelle did. So again, for those 52 counties where it's administered at the foster parent stage, they don't need to redo those questions. Again, they would only need to answer the questions that are relevant for
adoption
that haven't
okay.
been.
And that does happen
covered.
In those 52 counties.
Yep.
Okay.
So it's really a way of streamlining the processes that adoptive parents go through. Okay.
Let's just, can I take a second?
Oh, sure, of course.
Is there a time window within which that, sometimes foster parents are foster parents for a lengthy period of time before they decide to adopt? Is the safe tool readministered if there's a lapse in time? I mean, is it readministered in entirety, or is it just updated to reflect that component
the missing
that relates components. To adoption?
So a foster care license cannot exceed 2 years. So
they have to do it every time.
So every time it's renewed, a license is renewed, there is an updated process, and it's a abbreviated more of like what's changed
right.
since
that
the last assessment.
Right on target with my question. I was just curious. Thanks.
Okay. Great. So the next slide talks about another tool, which I, again, believe came up in some conversation, so we wanted to go over the use of that tool. So there is a national tool called the Child and Adolescent Needs and Strengths Tool. Its acronym is CANS, C-A-N-S. It's a tool that provides a comprehensive assessment of the child, again, of both the needs and the strengths of the child. It's been validated through national research to be shown to be accurate and effective. It's widely used. It's used in 42 states, either statewide or in parts of states. So we use it here in Wisconsin, and we use it for a couple of purposes. We require that when a child goes into out-of-home care through the child welfare system, that the CANS assessment be done within 30 days of the time that the child enters out-of-home care, and then every 6 months after that, that the child is still in out-of-home care. And one of the key purposes of doing that is to be able to use that to help us match a setting for the child where the parents have the knowledge and the abilities and school and skills to meet the child's needs. So to the extent we have a good assessment, a good picture of the child's needs, we can then match the child, hopefully with a very successful match at the foster parent stage. The CANS is also helpful in developing a service plan for the child, so understanding if the child needs therapies or other kinds of services. It's also used to determine a portion of the foster care rate and adoption assistance rate, because we want to set our reimbursement in a way that aligns with the complexity of the child. So if a child does have more complex needs, we want to reimburse the foster and adoptive parents with a higher reimbursement to reflect that. So the reason I think it was useful to bring this up in this committee, I know you're dealing with adoption and not the foster parent stage, but again, given that such a large proportion of our adoptive parents have been the foster parents, to the extent we get the match right at the foster parent stage, it really helps then provide a successful adoption match as well. And so that's why the CANS, in my mind, sort of indirectly helps us with a matching at the adoption stage too, because we use it and rely on it at that foster parent stage. Okay, so the next area I'll touch on is the pre-adoptive training. And I understand you talked about this a bit this morning too. Currently in Wisconsin, the pre-adoptive training requirements are laid out in administrative rule, DCF 51. Right now there's a total required number of hours are 18 hours. We do base our curriculum for pre-adoptive training on a national model that's called Partners in Alternative Care Education. There's lots of acronyms in this presentation. So that acronym is PACE. It is similar to or has components that are part of the PRIDE national curriculum, which I think was something that your committee studied. So we wanted to just bring that to your attention. The training does include information about trauma and the effect on children. The international adoptions have a somewhat different training requirement. They're required to take 10 hours of training. That's something that's established through the Hague requirements. And then for the adoptions that are finalized in the U.S., they are subject to those 18 hours of training that I just described, as are the domestic adoptions are required to do the 16 hours of the core training.
Okay, that's good.
Okay, so the next couple of slides deal with adoption assistance. Which again is something that's applicable to children in the public child welfare system. So a child is eligible for adoption assistance if the child meets the eligibility criteria for a special needs child, and that's established in one of our administrative rules in DCF 50. In general, virtually all children in the child welfare system do meet those criteria. So virtually all of our public adoption are eligible for adoption assistance. So the actual payment has three components. There's a basic rate, and that is the same as the basic foster parent rate that's established in statute. There's a supplemental rate, and that's driven and based on the CAMS tool that I just described, so it really now has become aligned with the complexity of the child, as I said, in a way that I think is quite helpful. And then there's a third component that may apply, doesn't apply in all cases, but is an exceptional rate component that kicks in if the child has exceptional needs or if there are unique circumstances of the family. So just to give you a little more background on adoption assistance, on average, the monthly payment per child is $900. That's our current average. Monthly payments can't exceed $2,000 per month per child. And then just to give you an idea of the scope, right now we're covering about 8,300 children each month with adoption assistance payments. And so over the course of a year, that comes to $91 million. And half of that is state funding, state general revenue. The other half is federal 4E funding, and I'll talk a little bit more about 4E funding later in the presentation. But the one of the important things to take away is that because it is funded in part with federal funding, the state does have to comply with all federal requirements.
Jacqueline.
So partly it's a federal requirement.
It's allowed, right.
It's
allowed under federal.
That's right. So everyone agrees. Right. And partly it's, it's a programmatic and policy consideration that these are children who would not, have permanency without having the option of adoption. And they are, in general, complex children with sometimes special need. And so that's really what's triggering the adoption assistance payment, is technically that special need that they have. It's a policy interest in having kids have permanent, safe, and nurturing homes. And for this group of children, their birth families are not a possible place for them to be safe and have a permanent home.
So for the slice that you mentioned earlier that have reunification with their birth families, is there any financial assistance that will go for those families to keep families together?
No. So those families, again, they're like any other family in the community. Correct. If a child has been in foster care and then is able to reunite back with their birth family, there's no longer a monthly payment that goes out. There is not a monthly payment that goes out to the birth family. If the child is adopted, it goes into foster care and is then adopted and has a special need, which again is they virtually all meet the special needs test, then there is a monthly payment, yes.
And the families may be eligible for other benefits, but depending on the family.
We're gonna hold questions till after they finish the presentation, so. Unless there's something, if you do have something really pressing specific to what they're talking about, we'll take them, but.
I just wanna make sure, did anybody else on the team here wanna say anything?
Some states have attempted to eliminate that payment and have run into legal problems because of it.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a requirement that states provide an option for adoption assistance payments.
If you want the foster care funding,
right.
There's as Freddie said, there's various requirements that go along with that. One of the things going back that I believe led to adoption assistance was they had the situation was that people would otherwise adopt these kids who had been in their homes for a few years, but if they adopted without it, when there was no adoption assistance, they lost the foster care payment. So
sure.
People not adopting just for that.
It's a disincentive to adopt.
Exactly.
Is there a, I'm not going to break my own rule. Go ahead.
Okay. Keep rolling here. Okay, so that's a great discussion. So adoption assistance does continue until the age of 18, until the child turns 18, unless one of the following occurs. Basically, unless the adoptee gets married, then that cuts off the payments. Obviously, if the adoptee dies, or if the adoptive parent dies, or if the adoptive parent is no longer providing support to the adoptee, then our payment would stop. Or if they're no longer legally responsible, our payment would stop. So the adoptive parent is required to report any of these changes in status to the department. So the onus is on the adoptive parent to report if the child gets married or any of these circumstances happen. The adoption assistance can extend to age 21 under certain circumstances. Some of you may be aware there was a bill that recently passed in the legislature that extended foster care to age 21 for youth who are still in high school, who are under an individualized education plan. The same provision applies to adoption assistance. So, for example, if a child is receiving adoption assistance and has an individualized education plan and stays in high school beyond 18, which they are entitled to do under the education laws, then the adoption assistance payment can also continue. Okay, so now we're going to move on to post-adoption and what our functions are in that area. So post-adoption, we really have two, the department has two main functions. We administer the payments that we just talked about, the adoption assistance payments, so we're the entity that's responsible for sending out those monthly payments. We also support the post-adoption resource centers, and I'll talk more about those in the next slide. I did want to highlight, and this is something I'm sure the committee is aware of, but that at the point of post-adoption, adoptive children and families really have the same legal status and are treated the same from the department perspective as birth families and other families in the community. So we do not, as a department, have any kind of routine check-ins with the public adoptive families. We don't have oversight over them. And that's partially because of federal requirements, but partially because of, again, philosophy and policy. These are families just like other families in our community. If there were to be a report of abuse and neglect with a adoptive family, it would be treated the same way as a report of abuse and neglect from any other family in the community. Post-adoption resource centers. There are six post-adoption resource centers. They're located throughout the state. They have a number of services. They provide a phone line, toll-free phone line, 24/7, so anyone who has a concern or issue can call. Any adoptive parent can call, whether it's a public adoption or a private adoption. The parks, as we call them, provide education, support, and other activities to adoptive families, including things like support groups, peer groups. They provide training. They also have a mission to increase community awareness of adoptions. That's one of the things they try to do. They try to connect families with services. So as Ray was pointing out earlier, these families may be eligible for other services. And they also perform advocacy services. Our practice at the department is to forward all of the names and contact information for finalized adoptions that come through the public adoption system to the parks so they can follow up, unless the parent opts out. So we do respect if a parent doesn't want to get contacted. Our data indicates that statewide, these centers have about 70 contacts per month. So the next slide just shows you the funding that is used to operate the parks. It's all federal funding, so there's a little less than $500,000 of funding, and they each get between $75,000 and $83,000 each. We also wanted to bring to your attention that there is a peer mentoring service that's available for adoptive parents. It's not one that the department is involved in or that we run or fund. It is run by the Wisconsin Association of Foster and Adoptive Parents Association, and their program is called Foster and Adoptive Support and Preservation Program. So it's a peer-driven volunteer network that's been established, and it's designed to have someone who has gone through the foster and adoptive system be a mentor to someone who's starting that process, and so help them explain the steps that they will experience and answer questions. They don't provide legal advice. The peer mentors obviously are not lawyers, but they do, again, help provide information and answer questions. They can also help refer the person to other information sources or other resource material. And that is a service that is available to any prospective adoptive parent. Okay, so the next two slides, I think, are material that you, again, had the benefit of through your staff memos, but we did want to just review that there are legal restrictions both at the state level and the federal level regarding the disclosure of the adoption status of an individual. So under state statutes, adoption records are closed except for the circumstances that are listed here. So we can use it, for example, to give a picture and description of the media if we're at the point of looking for adopted parents. We use it to provide information to the adoptive parents or the caseworker. It can be released after the adoptee turns 18 if the birth parent gives consent, and there's a process in our department for doing that. The information can be used for program administration and for state taxes because there are tax credits. There's a tax credit at the state and federal level. For adopted Indian children, there's a federal requirement that we provide information to the federal government, and then by court order we can release it. At the federal level, there's also restrictions because this is individually identifiable information on adoption, and that has to be held confidential except for the circumstances listed on the slide, which is, again, if it's related to administration of the federal programs, if it needs to be used in a criminal or civil proceeding, if it's part of an authorized federal audit, and if it's related to reporting requirements. Okay, the next area that the committee was interested in hearing us talk about is the training for child protective services workers. So this briefly gives you a summary. We can go into more detail if that's of interest. But I think the key points are that the requirements are set out in administrative rule, chapter 43. They are statewide, so there's no, again, standards apply to Milwaukee, non-Milwaukee counties, because in our view, it's important to have statewide standards that we are following for consistency and quality. There's three components. There's a pre-service training component that the worker completes before starting work. There's a foundation training component, which is 15 days of training that has to be completed within the first 2 years that they're working. And then every 2 years, they have a requirement to do 30 hours. Yeah, 30 hours of training. Right.
That's
wow,
right.
Wow, yeah, right. Really well trained, right? We do have a system that provides the training. We work with the University of Wisconsin system. There's an organization that's part of UW-Madison called the Child Welfare Professional Development System. That is the umbrella organization that administers the training through the regional UW institution. So it is regionally based, again, for convenience and accessibility for workers. So there are four UW institutions throughout the state that administer the training. All right, so getting to the last area. Federal child welfare funding. So the final slides really cover the funding levels that come from the federal government. And we are highly dependent on federal funding in the child welfare system. So there are three major federal sources of federal funding. The first is called Title 4B Part 1. They don't have very interesting names. They're all part of the Social Security Act, that's why they're different titles. The second is Title 4B Part 2. That is also called Promoting Safe and Stable Families, so you may have heard that name. And the last and biggest funding source is Title 4E. So if you go to Title 4B, Subpart 1 first. So 4B funding can be used for prevention purposes, as well as so that it can help support at-risk families, as well as families who are in the out-of-home care system. And that's an important distinction, because when we get to some of the other funding sources, they can only be used for children after they've entered the child welfare system. But 4B is more flexible. It can be used at that front end for prevention or in-home services, as well as other child welfare services. We get, as a state, we get about $4.8 million per year. Because we're a county-administered system, the bulk of that money is contracted out with counties, and so they can use it at their discretion to meet what their local needs are. There's a small portion that's used for the youth runaway program that's statewide. So it's a pretty similar situation with the 4B subpart 2 funding. It's also a fairly flexible funding source. It can be used for family support services, family preservation services, and adoption promotion and support. So it has the flexibility to be used after the child's been in the child welfare system. Our funding level for that funding source is $5 million a year. Again, the majority is distributed to the counties so that they can use it in the way that best suits their local needs. Okay, and the last funding source is the biggest, and it's the Title IV-E funding. So Title IV-E funding is really a reimbursement mechanism. So you can think of it a little bit like Medicaid funding, if you're familiar with that, that in the sense that it funds a part of expenditures for children who meet certain criteria in terms of financial criteria who are in out-of-home care settings. So again, the big thing to remember about 4E is that it really funds those activities when the child has already entered the child welfare system and is already in either foster care or some kind of out-of-home care setting. We receive about $108 million a year, so it's a big funding, the largest funding source, federal funding source for us. As I pointed out in the earlier slide, it can be used to support adoption assistance payments. And so that is, in fact, where the bulk of the money goes. There is $400,000 that's used for our special needs adoption program contracts, which are the people that help with that identification and recruitment of adoptive parents. They work under contract with the department. We use the money for education and training, and then the bulk, or the remainder, I should say, is used both in our Bureau of Milwaukee Child Welfare Program, and then in the county child welfare programs, and that's again distributed through a formula to counties so they can use it at their discretion. So I think I am at the end, and I'm happy to take any questions or.
My first question. I have two quick questions. One is that is there any mechanism in place for ferreting out adoption assistance abuses?
Right. So do you want to talk? Yeah, so I guess I'm going to make one comment, yeah. And then Ron can explain in a little more detail. So that's an issue that has been of concern to the department, making sure that, yes, once we start an adoption assistance payment, that the family is, in fact, continuing to support the child. So we have been looking at how can we assure program integrity in the program.
Right, and we do, when issues are brought to our attention, we do investigate them, but it is currently it's a self-report where the family has to let us know that they are no longer providing that support because we're not able to be in that family's, we're not able to be in that family's life, which in some ways, maybe we shouldn't be, but I understand what you're getting at. It is somewhat of a sticky wicket, if you will, of balancing the state's responsibility for oversight of those funds and the family's right to privacy and
right, but if they're getting, I mean, I understand right to privacy 100%, but if you're getting state aid,
yep.
If you're getting state taxpayer money, there should be a counter check of some sort.
And so
there really is no agency that polices it, or?
So we have, you know, in the past have sent letters out to the families requiring them to report back to us that they are still providing the care. we ran into some issues with the federal government on that. We are exploring options on how we can verify that the family is still providing care to the child.
Or the I just think that's an area we should look at potentially, because we spend a lot of money on it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. That is an area of concern for us as well.
The other quick question I had is, in your opinion, as an agency, is there any way we can legislate the earlier use of the parks? Because we always hear that. We hear about them in the at the crisis point. Is there any way to legislate? And you don't have to.
Maybe we need to think about that a little bit.
I'm not sure exactly what I mean. Yeah. I just mean that we have heard so often that we hear about these when they're in crisis. Then they probably contact the parks and they're like, it's falling apart. Where some things could be thwarted if they reached out sooner. And I don't know if that's a...
Just so you know, Representative, all adoptive families at the time of the finalization and their sign, they're provided all the information about the parks, and sometimes they don't hear it, right? Because there's a lot going on at that point in time and they're not hearing it. You know, they do, their information is provided to the park. Maybe Ori wants to speak a little bit to this too. And so there is a way to have contact if they choose. I mean, we can't force them though to reach out to a to one of the parks.
No, I understand that.
But,
it is very, very difficult. You know, and even as I explained, in addition to what's not on here, you know, we do have a substantial private donor in this state that is providing an opportunity for us to get out and visit those families, to go out to their house. But as Ron said, we're also not that far behind these guys. We're in that six months to first year.
Sure.
And at that time, I'm still happy, or I'm just glad social workers aren't in my life anymore. And so I'm done.
Sure.
And yeah, I wish I had an answer for you.
Well, there might not be an answer, but it's something to think about, because we do have the potential. Now, when we come back together, we're going to talk about some other options as well. Still, I mean, we're still in the. We will at our next meeting still have the opportunity to have some legislation drafted.
Can I ask one question about the adoption assistance?
Sure. Yeah.
Because I'm making myself public enemy number one. I do believe there are other states that haven't been. We've been a very generous state with our adoption assistance, and who have somehow managed to use some of that money towards more post-adoptive services and a lesser payment. That would be very unpopular, especially for these guys. And I don't know how those states have been able to do it. I know that there are other states that have.
I like it.
It's not popular with post-adoptive families.
Oh.
It is.
Sure.
It's not popular with some advocates that I would say that we're partners with.
Sure.
They believe that families should kind of decide for themselves, but no.
All right, we'll take general questions. Mary, God bless you. Mary, go ahead.
Well, there is, I'm just wondering, as far as it's similar to SSI payments, I would assume that when it is discovered, and it would be eventually, that there is an overpayment, then it would be required to be paid
back. Absolutely.
Correct?
Absolutely, yes.
Or there would be penalties.
Yes.
And then as far as the those monies are concerned, I mean, these are a lot of kids that are such severe behaviors that they would actually be in treatment homes, which are much higher rate than being in a private home. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty severe behaviors.
Paul?
You know, as far as the parks go, you have a funding on, I don't know what page it is, but what is the balance of that funding? I mean, does Green Bay operate on $75,000, or do they get county funding, or how does that?
That's the funding. That's it. That's been the funding, about the level of funding for 7 years, 10 years?
1999.
Yeah.
And those represent regions, correct?
Yes.
And then on the international adoptions, do they receive payments too, international?
No, they do not.
Okay.
Not on the initial adoption, but you can have an
international adoption.
On a readoption?
That as a readoption is eligible for those funds.
And does Department of Children and Family Services, do they seek out to get a reimbursement at all from, say, the birth parents as far as for these, you know, the adoption money that they pay?
Legally, when the birth parent, when the child's in foster care and the birth parents still have parental rights, generally there is an effort to seek child support.
Yep.
But once there's an adoption, the birth parents' rights are terminated.
Right.
So there's not, at least in how the law is looked at today, and you have to do real significant legal transformations on how people think about this, but once you take their parental rights away, they're no longer legally responsible for
right.
the child.
Right. I don't know that that's an area we want to...
No, I was just curious.
Change it. It's an interesting point.
So the answer is no.
Yeah.
Okay. That's why, because they're not legally responsible.
In foster care, you do. See,
yes.
But
yes.
After,
yes.
No.
Representative Johansson, go ahead.
I know that with DCF, you can't discriminate against your foster or your adoptive parents. So regardless of what socioeconomic background they come from or disability that they may have, that they still have a right to foster and adopt. Like, for example, a special needs parent may be adopting a special needs child.
Can I clarify?
So there are parts of code that are non-discriminatory. However, there are also parts that speak to your capacity to parent. So just because you have a mental illness doesn't mean you can't parent. It's how that mental illness impacts your ability to parent, or a physical disability impacts your ability to parent. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. And that's a part of the assessment process that someone has to go through. So there are instances where someone's cognitive abilities do limit their ability to become a foster and adoptive parent. You don't have a right to become a foster or adoptive parent. It is a license and an approval that you do have to complete with the department.
And, well, the only reason I'm asking is because with my background as a child care provider, I have seen some adoptive parents that were questionable and who also had referrals to CPS post-adoption, but then there's not much you can do except offer services.
Right.
What are the restrictions that will prevent individuals from becoming foster and adoptive parents besides a troubled background check?
So it would depend on how it affects your capacity to parent and through that assessment process. So, you know, a lot of people, life changes impact how you can parent. Future, you could be fine during the approval and the adoption, and something major happens to you. You're in a car accident, you have brain damage, that can impact your ability to parent. It could happen to you or I. And I'm a parent myself, and that kind of thing could happen to me and impact my ability to parent in the future. Right now I'm okay, but I mean, those things happen. And then we as a system have to respond to those that come to our attention when it happens.
So basically,
oh no, there's a full, there's a very large assessment. I mean, DCF 56, which is the licensing code that all adoptive parents have to meet the criteria of, is very thorough. I mean, we look at people's physical environments, their capacity to parent on many different aspects, and that's what is wrapped up in a home study. So those counties that, and agencies that use the SAFE study, it would be that process. And for other counties, they have, or other agencies, they have to complete a home study that covers all of those different aspects. Now, do some people do those better than others? Yes. And sometimes what's present at the time you're approving them is different than what happens 5 years down the road when a life change circumstance happens and your capacity to parent changes.
The only reason I'm asking that question is because from my experience, even in some instances now, I have seen children be removed from their home, only to be placed in a home that's maybe marginal, just a little bit better than the home that they were in. I had a little boy who was removed from a home because the mother had cognitive issues, but was placed in an adoptive home with a single parent that had cognitive issues. And the sad part about it is that you knew that that child would never receive the help that they needed to overcome their obstacles because there was nobody there to advocate for it. Not because the parent was a bad parent, it was just because cognitively he would not know how to.
Yeah. And I'm not here standing and saying everyone is doing those appropriately, and if we hear of, you know, improper approvals or licensing agencies that are doing decisions that aren't appropriate, that's something that on our licensing side we would review their practice, and you know, those, there's challenges in doing that too. It's not like we go in and review every single home study that a private agency is doing.
The other thing maybe to keep in mind, and I mean we're all concerned about cases that don't, situations that don't go well for kids. So we do think about it a lot, but there are some protections. One, we try to do as good a job, and our partners do as good a job as they can, and the county is picking those foster homes and going through the adoptive process. But kids, until their parents' rights are terminated, they have a guardian ad litem. The courts review the placements, have to sign off on the placements. So again, it's an important issue. It's one we try to work really hard on. There are certain checks and balances. They don't always work. Sometimes we don't know about things until later, or things change. So I know there are those situations. That's what we have now to work with.
Okay. Ms. List.
I guess I'm under the impression from listening to conversations that there seems to be a lot of circumstances where the money doesn't follow the kids, where people continue to receive benefits after the kids
are. I wouldn't say that there's a, no.
It don't seemed like a big conversation at one of our sessions where we're talking about the money following the kids. No?
Again, we don't have hard and fast data. There have been a handful of cases that have come to our attention. We have pursued them. In some cases, we found that, yes, in fact, the parent was still involved. In some cases, they weren't. So, again, there are a pretty small number of cases that have come to our attention.
And Freddie, that's a good point. You have to understand that just because the child has been removed or is no longer in the home doesn't mean that that adoptive parent is ineligible for that adoption assistance payment continually. So there are circumstances if that adoptive parent is still providing any level or amount of care for that child or support to that child, even though they're not in the home, they, under the federal regulations, can continue to receive that payment.
And we do collect.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Right. We do collect child support from the adoption assistance. So,
and then my other question, looking at the funding and the. It sounds like to me like it comes in large sums of money coming to the state, and the state divvies it up between, you know, regions and different block grants. It seems like it's very weighted on the front end. Maybe I'm just not understanding the numbers. And a lot of the discussion has been about these kids get into crisis, and a lot of the disruptions happen in their teens, where you've got this troubled 14, 15-year-old, and now it's time to get rid of them. And it seems like the funds that are allocated toward, you know, the youth and the runaway services, and again, it seems kind of weighted rather low. Seems how that seems where a lot of the crisis seems to occur.
Yeah. So let
me. Is there a way to distribute? Is that an option?
Well, so let me try to explain that a little bit better. So the money that goes, the bulk of the money, which again goes to counties, it's not distinguished by age, and 4E funding is not distinguished by age. So it can apply to any age child. And so, again, given the array of kids in our system, there are a significant number of youth and teens that are supported by that federal money. It's flowing through the counties. The youth runaway services, again, that's just a little bit of federal money that, again, through the budget process that the legislature looks at every year, they made a decision that a small amount of that money, rather than going to counties, should go specifically for this runaway program, which does serve older youth, not younger youth. But again, that's not the only money that's going to youth. The youth are getting a large chunk of that 4E money and the 4B money that goes to counties.
Is it sufficient? I guess that's the question.
Well,
yes, that's what I'm looking
question.
At millions and four, you know, 4.8 mil, and you know, and again, I don't understand
right.
the requirements for distribution. I don't point to, you know, 108 mil, and then you're talking 400 or 800,000.
Yes.
For
so,
youth, that seems
no.
Well,
but the youth part, again, that's only a very specific program.
Right.
There's still lots of that 4.8 million in 4B money. That goes to youth other
okay.
than the Youth Runaway Program. Okay.
okay. And then
but I think the big takeaway for our state and every state, it's a national conversation, is that there's a lot of federal money that goes into the out-of-home care costs. So while a child's in
sure.
foster care,
right.
there's relatively little that goes before that for prevention and trying to keep families stable. So that's where the imbalance happens in terms of the federal money.
And how much discretion does the state have in the distribution of those funds to address those?
So 4E money, which was that last funding source I
right.
talked about, that we you can only earn through expenditures that you make on expenses related to the out-of-home care system or adoption assistance. You can't get that money if you put in place a great prevention program. The feds won't give you 4E money for it. That's the dilemma.
Skalik?
The adoption assistance payment levels, it says that it cannot average about $900 per child, and the next $2,000, that's per child.
Correct.
Correct.
So
per
is
month,
there a cap?
Per child.
Is there a cap for families?
No.
Like if I'm fostering, I'm
it's on a per child,
six,
per child basis.
That could be.
It's a per child.
Collectors.
There are regulations in terms of the numbers
yes.
of children you can care for, and that would include birth, adopted, and foster, or kids that you're providing respite for. And agencies can decide to make decisions about that. But there are regulations about that.
Rep. Johnson.
You talked about the youth runaway services, and
yep.
I have a question about that.
Sure.
What are they? Are these just runaway services for children that are actually in the department's custody? Or because I thought the department didn't deal with runaways.
Right, so we have this little part of money that we contract out with agencies throughout the state. I'm gonna get the acronym right, but the Wisconsin Association of Homeless and Runaway Services, I believe. The acronym is. And so they have shelters and other services throughout the state. It's not just for children in the child welfare system, so it can serve any child. Pathfinders is one in Milwaukee that you may be familiar with. And so, again, it's there as a resource for youth who are running and homeless. So this was a decision the legislature made to allocate a chunk of that federal money for that purpose, and so we have followed that direction.
So it's essentially for shelter from these kids, or just for
shelter and outreach services. So there typically are workers who they call them street outreach workers who will go out in the street, and if youth are homeless, will try to assist them either to a shelter or back to their family, get them counseled so they can be in a safe place. One way or the other.
So does the state keep track of how many children these agencies service who receive these funds? Is there any way to know how many youth runaways we have in the state based on the information that they gather, or does the state not keep track of it?
I would have to check on exactly what figures we have. I think we'd have some figures on the number of youth who are receive services through these organizations. That would not be the total number of homeless youth in the state, because there would be youth who don't access the services. But if that's of interest,
right.
yeah, I certainly can go back and provide whatever data we have on the number of youth that utilize this service. We also, I should just, as an aside, add that we've done an interesting collaboration and partnership with the Department of Administration, which runs the adult homeless shelters, and so we did a data sharing agreement with them and found out how many former foster youth are using the adult shelters shortly after aging out of foster care, and we can provide that study to you too. That was
Because I think Milwaukee did something like funding for 16 beds to serve over 600 youths that are homeless, and this 700,000 pot is supposed to be spread throughout the
state. It's spread throughout the state, yeah.
Yeah, that's scary.
Yeager.
Yes. I was wondering, I almost forgot, can you provide some detail on if a child reaches that 2,000 cap, what kind of needs that might be, just so everyone
Is that severe cognitive usually?
Well, it could be severe medical, cognitive, developmental, physical needs. It could be any of them.
So as long as it reaches that high. Mm-hmm. And then are these subsidies when adoption preparation and adoption finalization is happening, are these subsidies to provide for the needs of the child so they can use it for therapy and medical use, whatever the parent feels to help
so that
child?
You can't use it to purchase services that are Medicaid reimbursable. Because just like any child in the community, they're eligible to receive those services through a Medicaid program. And these children qualify for Medicaid continuing. But they could qualify for children's long-term support through a DHS-administered program if they have those type of needs. It's really for reimbursement of costs incurred, so clothing costs, shelter costs, additional time maybe away from work or training that they may have to go to, things like that. Transportation, if maybe they have siblings or maybe they are still doing contact with some of the birth family members, things like that.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, we got a couple things to think about for next time anyway. I think we did have a really fantastic start on the legislation that we were talking about. I know my staff, Ashley's got some ideas to talk with me about after the meeting. So if you do come up with legislative ideas before the next meeting, get in touch with our office because we can have those potentially drafted for the next time. Even if they're drafted and set aside to talk about, we'll have a draft ready. Margit is going to be, are you going to have help or are you solo?
I'm not sure.
You're flying solo maybe? Which is just fine with us. If Van wants to jump ship, we'll let her. And a very sincere thank you to Ann for the years of assistance and help. You're really terrific and I wish you the best. So thanks everybody. Have a great day. Have a safe ride home.